Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Well, in the second hour of today's show, it is my great pleasure to welcome back to Truth News Radio Professor Robert Carter, formerly of the University of Townsville in Queensland, and the James Cook University in Queensland. He's based in Townsville. And, of course, Bob Carter is well known around the world for his research and his very independent views on climate and his expert knowledge of paleoclimatology going back many, many years. Being a geologist, he has very, very important contribution to make into the questions about the climate of the Earth, particularly over the very, very long periods of time. And when we are told by the media through very, very loudly trumpeted reports from the IPCC, which always get a lot of coverage on our ABC and other mainstream news sources, when we are told that that things have reached a very perilous state and there's been unprecedented levels of warming and carbon dioxide levels are at unprecedented levels, it's very interesting to take it from a perspective of deep time. And you'll notice that most climate scientists don't take that perspective. They operate within a much narrower time frame, and most of them don't even have the expertise involved in looking at deep time. So it is my great pleasure now to welcome to the show Professor Bob Carter.
Hello, Harold. It's nice to be with you and your listeners again.
Indeed. And it's very great to have you on because we have a lot to deal with at the moment. We really do have what seems to be a build-up again of global PR, and we're seeing it from the President of the United States. I mean, I was just watching a television coverage of President Barack Obama in Myanmar talking about climate change as one of the key issues in his relationship with Myanmar. And of course, a new deals signed up between the US and China, and we've seen the release of the synthesis report from the IPCC, which has got so much coverage. It seems to me that we're really building again with the paranoia over climate change has really taken off again, whereas it seemed to have died down for a little while there.
Well, it's a cultivated paranoia. It's not held by the general public. It's amongst those who are lobbying for this that the paranoia exists. And that's exactly the right word, paranoia. They're paranoid because they have lost the scientific argument. And this goes back to the Copenhagen conference when we came within an ace, we being the world, of signing up to another disastrous protocol like the previous Kyoto Protocol, which cost over $2 trillion and had no effect on climate whatsoever. You might as well have stood under the shower and torn up billion-dollar notes. Now, the people that were responsible for that, mostly the environmental lobby groups, then wanted to impose a successor to that. And the Copenhagen conference came within an ace of doing that, but it didn't. And that's when the paranoia set in. So it's interesting, people like me who have an agnostic view on human-caused climate change, yes, in principle, human carbon dioxide emissions are affecting global temperature because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So it was a very good question to ask back in the late 1980s, well, mightn't that cause dangerous warming? And that was a sensible question to ask. But we're now 25 years down the track. We've spent several hundred billion dollars on research, and we know the answer. And the answer is that we cannot detect a human signal outside the bounds of natural variability of the climate system. In other words, the human signature is tiny. Now, any scientist that's looked at this problem knows that. But despite that, you're quite right, you said there's this PR campaign. It's much more than a PR campaign. It's an organized global propaganda campaign from all those who have a self-interest in pursuing climate alarm, and we can tease out who they are later if you wish. And now it's focused not on Copenhagen, which is past and gone, but on the next meeting, which is being held in Paris, December 2015. So the present hullabaloo will be repeated successively every couple of months around different meetings here, there, or press events or announcements by the IPCC, you can expect this propaganda to go on crescendoing up until December next year. I'm sorry to tell you that, because it's awfully boring listening to it on the news. The public are totally past it. They're just not interested in this topic any longer. But the professional campaigners will ensure, with the support, of course, of the mainstream media, which you referred to, which is a big problem, will ensure that the public of the world are bombarded with this stuff for another 12 months and more now.
Yeah, indeed. And this is something I've been talking about on the show, and I had a long rant about it last week. In one sense, democracy has prevailed, and that's something to feel good about, because For a while there, it felt like the government was completely trampling over the will of the people when Julia Gillard, of course, you know, reversed her promise over no carbon tax. However, we saw the return of the LNP to power, I think largely because of that deceit from the Labor Party. And, of course, that's not got a lot of mention, but it's not well admitted. But that really, to me, as an observer, and again, like you, I'm agnostic, I'm dispassionate. I'm not against, in principle, that we might be putting things into the environment that are wrong, and I would certainly be the first person to say we should do something about it if we were. But what I see happening is with the deceptions and the deliberate reversals of agreed policy is that there is a deceptive style behind everything that is done.
It's more than deceptive, Herbert. It's deliberately misleading. Let me read you, and I will pause between each word, a short list of words. And it goes like this: carbon, pollution, carbon pollution, denier, pause in temperature rise, clean energy, dirty coal. 97% of all scientists say, all the world's scientific societies say, and then the use of the word belief, they will say to you, do you believe in climate change? And this has become a religion. Now, all those weasel words are actually deliberately designed propaganda words to hit the switch. Instead of talking about the elixir of life, a colourless, odourless gas, carbon dioxide, which is not just environmentally beneficial, it's environmentally essential. Without it, the world's ecosystems as we know them would collapse. So instead of talking about carbon dioxide, a great benefit to the world, they talk about carbon. And they're raising images, of course, in your mind of living little floating particles. They do that quite deliberately. Well, you might say that doesn't matter. They're just the NGOs. They rave on about this, that, and the other. President Obama, in his statement you just referred to with the Chinese Prime Minister the other day, uses the same terminology, carbon pollution. It is deliberate deception. It's not just lying, it's deliberate deception. So the whole thing is based on this myth that carbon dioxide is somehow environmentally disbeneficial. Well, ask any horticulturalist and ask most biologists, and they will tell you, well, that's not right at all. Of course carbon dioxide isn't a pollutant. But you will say, oh, the US Supreme Court said that it was a pollutant. And indeed they did. And what that shows is the complete incompetence of our legal and political system to adjudicate on a scientific matter. It's not just scientifically wrong, it's scientifically grotesque to call carbon dioxide a pollutant. So getting back to where you started me off there, yes, there is deliberate use of misleading language. I call it weasel words the whole time, and it is done in order to enforce an almost religious belief in this environmental credo that carbon dioxide is somehow bad for the environment.
Yes, and I would add to that some of the arguments that are used, using all kinds of fallacious techniques, such as, you know, argument from authority or argument from consensus, and one that is commonly used now is the claim that 98% of practicing climate scientists all agree. And they've added that kicker, practicing climate scientists, to rule out people like you as being worthy of an opinion.
Of course, but that the figure varies between 97 and 98%, but both figures are ludicrous. And that was one of the items on my list, and that list of weasel words, if you're involved in a discussion of this, and the person you're discussing it with, be he or she the President of the United States or not, uses one of those words, yes, you know at that point you're not having a scientific discussion. You're, yes, having a political discussion. So that argument, 97% or 80% of all scientists say, is totally ludicrous. And as you say, they hedge it with a little caveat so they can control what that number in their minds means.
Perhaps let's just talk a little bit about the difference between a practicing climate scientist and someone like yourself and many other people, of course, of different scientific expertise around the world who have an opinion on this. What is it that differentiates that group, which apparently all speak as one, from you in terms of your knowledge and grasp of what's really going on here?
Yes, how long's your program?
it's probably a tricky question.
Yeah, very good question. However, the reality is that the people that drive this debate and that call themselves climate scientists and won't allow anybody else to be called a climate scientist, the great majority of them come from the disciplines of meteorology, atmospheric physics, computer modelling. Now, they do not consider somebody who looks at the history of climate change over the long term, such as geologists do, as a climate scientist. So there's a real irony straight away there, because climate takes place over hundreds to thousands to millions of years, not over a few years. And the people who know about that record and how climate behaves are not the meteorologists and not the atmospheric physicists, it's the geologists. So it's that sort of clever choice of discrimination between different disciplines and being in the position of power, that's the key point, whereby they can impose that discrimination. So what's their position of power? And the answer is they advise the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So this, the core of this scare campaign comes from the United Nations, comes from a group of scientists and a much bigger group of bureaucrats and lobbyists that comprise the IPCC. And the scientists who advise the IPCC are appointed by governmental agencies. So they're not, in a sense, disinterested scientists. They are representing their country. Now, having said that, I don't want to be silly. There are some excellent scientists, first-rate scientists, who advise the IPCC. But the fact remains that there's also hundreds of bureaucrats controlling what goes on in the IPCC. And the fact you're an excellent scientist doesn't mean very much if you're within a framework where you're required to reflect your government's views.
Yes, and of course, some very notable skeptics, like Judith Curry, formerly advised the IPCC, now presenting a different perspective.
Yes, the only surprising thing about that is, firstly, there's so few of those.
Yes.
Because Judith is the latest of perhaps half a dozen other names I could give you.
Sorry, Professor Carter, we're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back after this very short break. Don't go away. Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Herewood Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today. Radio, and my guest today is Professor Bob Carter. an expert in paleoclimate, a geologist with who has specialised in climate going back millions of years on our planet. Now, Professor Carter, just before we were cut off there, you were mentioning about the minority of IPCC scientists, such as Judith Curry, who've actually deviated from the dogma.
Yes, who've broken ranks.
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of others, but there's not a large number, to be fair. But those people know the IPCC from the inside, and so it's particularly significant when they decide they will basically leave that organisation and make independent comment. The interesting fact is that when Judith did that a couple of years ago, she then joins a group of scientists who have no axe to grind, as we said earlier.
Yes.
You and I are in that category. Independent scientists. And if you were to ask me, the IPCC claims, for example, that it's advised by 2,000 or 3,000 scientists. That's nonsense. The IPCC is advised by about 300 or 400 scientists, plus 2,600 bureaucrats. Okay, they count everybody who works for the organisation as a scientist when they give you that number. But nonetheless, there you have a group of several hundred scientists advising the IPCC. I don't challenge that. But at the same time, there are thousands, not just hundreds, but thousands of independent scientists who have signed documents saying, yes, they've looked at the IPCC's question, and it's a good question. We should look at whether carbon dioxide emissions are emissions are causing dangerous global warming. But we have looked, and we don't think there's a problem. In other words, we think the IPCC is exaggerating the situation. So there are many more scientists in that independent category than there are scientists advising the IPCC. But, of course, science isn't about numbers. In other words, just because there's more scientists that don't think it's a problem doesn't necessarily mean that is the correct view. That's the trick that the IPCC constantly tries to pull. It tries to say all qualified scientists, all climate scientists think this is a problem, and they define what a qualified or a climate scientist is, such that it's just them and their mates. But it has no standing in science to argue that five professors argue this way, one professor argues that way, and therefore we'll go with the five. That's just nonsense.
Yeah, it's really a political situation that that is leveraging the power of science as its method, as its main force to convince the people, governments, to go along with an agenda. But it is extremely dangerous, would you say, in principle, when this is done. I mean, do you think that there is that there are situations where we do really need to defer to science to make policy, or is this always going to be a situation where science can be corrupted to suit policy? Because it can affect a lot of other questions in our world as well.
Well, I'm afraid that, yes, science has lost her virginity. And that's the main reason I'm in this game. It's not the global warming issue as such. Important though that is, it is the damage that's being done to the science enterprise with a capital S as such. Grievous damage has been done. It's not going to be done in the future. It has been done to the point that science now has much, much less credibility with the public and to a degree with the politicians than it had before. So I think the answer to your question is yes. The days of innocence have passed. The days when Western democracies based their governance on the principles of the Enlightenment are now past. They went about 10 to 20 years ago. And we are now using basically political gamesmanship to run our governments and our countries. And that's very, very sad. And to refer to items on the news, at the same time, we have this brilliant European Space Agency mission landing that tiny little spacecraft Philae on a comet, which is a magnet. It's more of an engineering achievement than it's actually a scientific achievement. But that is the very pinnacle of all that we can do. If you can keep science and engineering pure, keep it away from the politicians, then that's the sort of magnificent discovery you can have. And unfortunately, the money to do that has to come from politicians.
Yeah.
And politicians 20 years or so ago decided they're only going to provide money for things that they think are important. They have no scientific grounds for deciding that topic A is more important than topic B, but they have lots of political grounds. So, you know, I believe now it's true in all Western countries that the politics of science funding is corrupted, and it's by the governments themselves, basically.
And let's talk a bit about the effect of this politics on real people in the world. In your email to me yesterday, you described the emissions deal between China and the USA as an attack on the poorest citizens of the planet. Can you just talk to that and explain that for our listeners? Why is that so?
Well, the aim of the people that want to close down the coal mines and the coal-fired power stations, their aim is to do that for political reasons. And so what they're then doing is saying, well, that's dirty power, which it isn't, with proper filters and scrubbers and so on fitted. A modern coal-fired power station is a very clean form of energy. But they badge it as dirty power. So that's the weasel word. That's the first trick in the book. And then they use all sorts of political gambits to try to get these power stations closed down or to stop new ones being funded. And this first came to a head about 10 years ago when South Africa wanted to build a big new conventional coal-fired power station. And there was a huge argument at the World Bank as to whether or not they would put up the money for that. And countries like Germany and the UK were arguing vehemently against that on the political grounds that coal-fired power stations aren't acceptable environmentally because of the carbon dioxide they produce. So that has spread from there, and it's now become almost impossible for a third world country to get a loan from an international agency to build a coal-fired power station. The money will just not be provided. So what you then do by doing that is you deny the power of development to the countries in the world that most desperately need it. The only way out of poverty and third world status as a country is the generation of cheap energy to enable you to do all sorts of things, including to a degree industrialize your country, but even more importantly to provide the basic amenities that we in the West take for granted, like refrigeration and lighting and heating and air conditioning and all the rest of them. So if you deny an underdeveloped country that right, then you will cause deaths. There are more than 1 billion people in the world, the United Nations estimate, that lack clean drinking water, adequate sanitation, elementary schooling, and basic health care. More than 1 billion people. The UN estimates that that problem could be addressed for around $60 to $70 billion a year. Now, we are currently spending, we being the world, $360 billion a year, $1 billion a day, on this global warming nonsense and energy matters related to it. So think that through. We could solve the major problems of the developing world in terms of giving them cheap energy and helping them with their health systems and so on for a sum that is basically one-sixth of what we are spending every year already on this carbon pollution nonsense. So of those $1 billion that are spent every day across the world on climate finance, what percentage do you think is actually spent helping vulnerable societies to adapt to climate change? And there's no way you'll know the figure, but it's actually 6%. It's a tiny percentage. That is morally grotesque. For Western nations, and now the President of the United States and the President of China, to deny third world nations the loans needed to build coal-fired power stations will result in a lack of development and in many deaths in those impoverished countries.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Very important interview, folks. Don't worry. Don't go away.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking to my guest, Professor Bob Carter. And we've just been talking about the effect on developing nations, on the poorest nations, on countries that haven't yet developed a significant industrial infrastructure, and how are they ever going to dig themselves out of the poverty trap. And I'm thinking of Africa largely being in that boat. Are there particular parts of the world that you think are particularly
Africa, South America, and some parts of Southeast Asia, they're the three hot spots, as it were. But just finishing that line of thought, the Western world, and particularly the United Nations as the lead agency, has done this at least once before when they banned DDT. The result of banning DDT over the 20 or so years that the ban lasted was to cause tens of millions of deaths in third world countries particularly. The result of banning coal-fired power stations will similarly cause tens of millions of deaths over a period of a decade or two. And an American writer, in my view quite rightly, has termed this technique or this phenomenon environmental genocide. That's what it is.
Yes.
It's deliberate choice of technological genocide. It's the deliberate choice of not using a particular technology, be it DDT or be it cheap energy, because of some presumed environmental problem or greater moral call, and the result of that then is people die, lots of them.
On that note, let's just address the question of what we see as being the agenda at work here. Now, recently, again in the media, we've seen the people who are critical of government. I'm thinking particularly MP George Christensen, who's in the NLP, sitting member, who questioned the government's Bureau of Meteorology's suppression of historical climate data. He was accused of being a conspiracy theorist. And it's rare that we see someone, actually a sitting member of a government, now being accused of being a conspiracy theorist. But this term, of course, is continually used to silence dissent. Personally, I have no problem with being a conspiracy theorist on some topics. That, after all, is what I do on this show. I am sometimes speculating, but with evidence based on research. But, of course, the word is used to make you look like a fool, look like a maniac. Now, the question, though, sorry for the sort of rambling introduction to this, but I just want to propose to ask you, Professor Carter, and feel free to decline the question, but do you see there is some sort of agenda at work here, or is this really the product of colossal incompetence and greed on a smaller scale that's just created a monstrosity?
It's much more than incompetence. It's determined ignorance.
Yeah.
If you take in determined ignorance plus greed, that explains a lot of it.
Yeah.
But the former member and part founder of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore, has recently been touring Australia, and he has a very nice analogy he uses for this, which is there are strong elements of conspiracy in what's going on, but it's not a conspiracy in the sense that somebody is sitting up there at the peak of a pyramid of organisation pulling the strings and everybody else is in neatly ordered structure below doing the bidding of that person. It's not a conspiracy of that sort. Rather, it is a waterfall, and this is Patrick's term, it's a waterfall of self-interest.
Mm.
Now, I just mentioned earlier that around $1 billion a day is being spent on this worldwide. $360 billion a year, that's a lot of money. And all the major interest groups that are lobbying for this problem will, one way or another, be feeding off that waterfall. The one group that's very influential that isn't perhaps directly financially implicated are the politicians. But the politicians trade not in dollars, but in votes. And their desire in all of this is to use it to electoral advantage. So there's self-interest of other types than just financial self-interest, but the overriding dominant fact is a waterfall of money every year, and all these groups scrabbling to get their part of it, be they research scientists that want money for research, be they NGOs that want money to do their agenda, be it the churches that want to get more people through their doors and are seen these days as being a little bit irrelevant. So what better topic to support than the global warming one? Because people will come, they're interested, or they, I'm not sure they are any longer, but they used to be interested in that. The financial markets, if you have a carbon dioxide tax, which thank God we've just repealed, but if you have one, then every time a trade takes place, does the carbon dioxide get delivered to your doorstep? Mm. Of course it doesn't. What happens is a little piece of paper changes hands. And on the way past, the big finance companies that are running these schemes just go clip. And every time they clip the ticket, they get a little amount of money, but the volume of carbon dioxide trading that was going on, that was a huge amount of money potentially for them. So it's no surprise that the banks and the big accountancy firms and the financial market in generally were hugely powerful and remain hugely powerful people pushing this particular scare.
So it's a cascading effect of driven by somewhat narrow-minded, somewhat ignorant, somewhat greedy tendentiousness in our culture. I mean, you could perhaps look at it as somewhat of a decline in our civilization or in civilized morals.
Oh, I do indeed look at it that way. But it's been brilliantly marketed. You underestimate the marketing and PR capabilities of these people at your peril. And they're doing what the churches have done over hundreds of years. They've twigged, and largely it's the big environmental organizations that are at the core of this, but they've twigged that the one thing that is in all of us, because we're brought up by our mothers this way, is a sense of guilt.
Yeah.
So by touching that button, we all want to look after Mother Earth, and you demonize carbon dioxide, and therefore we want to reduce that, and if you don't want to help us do that, you're not looking after Mother Earth. And so they hit that guilt button time and time again, and people are incredibly vulnerable to that. Then the second psychological phenomenon that's going on here is the herd instinct. Mm. All of us, you and me included, are vulnerable to what our peer group thinks. We like to think we're independent people, but for the average person in the community, the views they express publicly are largely determined not by their own beliefs, but by what they think is acceptable in the group they are talking to. Yeah. So the combination of exploiting that natural phenomenon of all humans, plus the guilt button in all humans, has allowed the vested interests to get away with doing the damage they've done and demonizing what is actually the elixir of life on the planet. Carbon dioxide is environmentally beneficial.
An incredibly important gas, a gas that drives all of the base of nature, all the plants on Earth breathe it and produce the richness of this Earth.
Well, Heriot, I should take that opportunity to say something which to me is the single most important set of scientific facts relevant to this debate, and it's the following. That between 1979 and 1997, there was a phase of gentle warming. Now that, in world temperature, that warming was no greater and no lesser than many other previous warmings earlier in the climate record.
Yes.
But there was a warming. There's no evidence whatsoever it was caused by humans, but humans might have contributed to it. Okay. Now, in 1997, that warming came to a stop. And since 1997, 17 years, there has been no warming at all, and at the moment, the global temperature is gently declining. Over those 17 years, there has been a 10% increase in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. That 10% increase represents 33%, one-third, of all the industrially related carbon dioxide that we have put into the atmosphere since 1850. interesting, if you like, the start of the Industrial Revolution.
We're just going to break. We are with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break. I'm talking to Professor Bob Carter. Really interesting talk. We'll be back for one more segment. Don't go away. Radio, and I'm talking to Professor Bob Carter, and we're just finishing up here talking about the last period of warming and the last few decades of the climate on this earth. And Professor Carter, you might want to just finish the thought there where you were talking about the...
I will, because it's vitally important. So we've had 17 years of no warming, at the same time that an increase in carbon dioxide of 10% has occurred, and that 10% represents one-third of all the carbon dioxide that we've put in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. Those facts are a very strong test of the hypothesis that human-caused carbon dioxide emissions are causing dangerous global warming. They are not, and that test directly shows it. It is inconceivable that the Western governments of the world continue to pursue the policy they are pursuing at the moment. It is morally reprehensible with respect to their own impoverished citizens, but particularly with respect to third world countries. And it also neglects their duty of care to their own citizens, because given that the warming has stopped in 1997, and you hear people talk of the pause, Anybody that uses that term flags the fact but they're not a scientist and don't understand science. If you think there's been a pause of 17 years, you are claiming that you know the warming is going to resume in the future. Mm. Well, only witch doctors and soothsayers do that, not scientists. So there is no pause, despite the fact that is the term that is used widely in the media. Global warming stopped in 1997. It may or may not resume, or it may continue its current cooling. There are very good world-leading solar physicists who believe we are entering now 2 to 3 decades of cooling, and that cooling may be strong enough to reduce the plant yields of the major northern hemisphere grain-growing areas in Canada, northern US, Siberia, and Europe, to reduce the productivity of those areas by between 10 and 20% if a cooling, say, of 0.5 degree to 1 degree took place. This is at a time when we are now just currently feeding the world, but only just. We don't have a big buffer. So it's incredible, because you have governments who are totally focused on a political agenda which is morally obnoxious, financially damaging. Virtually every Western nation has had a doubling in power prices because of all this stuff in the last 10, 15 years. And finally, which ignores the biggest environmental problem that we face, which is probably cooling, and then certainly stress on the world food supply.
Now, Professor Carter, we've only got a few more minutes left, but I'd like to just, if you can, very briefly address some of the points which I was going to base this show around, but we've talked about other things that are probably far more important. But some of the points that were raised by Leslie Hughes in the recent interview on the ABC, and I only say that because it came across as a fairly scary kind of interview. And I spent last week's show critiquing it from my own, admittedly, non-technical perspective, but I think I made a number of valid points. Let's just maybe single out some of the key points from what Leslie Hughes said on the ABC. And let's start off with the very scary 800,000 years figure for CO2 levels, the highest in 800,000 years.
Just before we do that, I'm not to play an ad hominem game, but can I just ask who Leslie Hughes is?
Well, indeed.
Is she a climate scientist?
She was presented as a lead author on the IPCC. I had never heard of her before. She appears to be an Australian. She's got an Australian accent. I don't really know much about her.
I believe she's a professor of biology, and I'm completely unclear why you would ask a professor of biology
That's
about
interesting.
These issues. But leaving that aside, the claim is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is higher than it's been in 800,000 years, and the answer to that is, so what?
Yeah.
I mean, what on earth is the significance of that statistic? Carbon dioxide now is 10 times less than it was 500 million years ago when metazoan, multicellular life, first evolved with physiology similar to the modern animals we have on the planet. So we know perfectly well that the sort of life we have, carbon-based life, thrives perfectly well in levels of carbon dioxide up to 10 times the present level. And the suitable time frame for that is several hundred million years. Just picking, 600 or 800,000 years, it's just ludicrous. It's a totally unscientific statement.
Indeed.
Because it's designed to mislead. It doesn't tell you anything that's significant. It's designed to mislead.
Another point. She said that we have had a degree of warming since pre-industrial times, and that the IPCC is saying there will be 3.7 to 4.8 degrees rise by the end of this century. Can we just deconstruct what this degree of warming since pre-industrial times actually represents?
Well, the first part of that statement can be said to be true, but I'll give you a caveat on the second. The second part of the statement is total nonsense. So the first part of the statement is there's been about degrees warming in the last 100 years. Yes, prima facie, that is the case based upon our best temperature records, which come from thermometer measurements made through the 20th century. However, those measurements, especially in the earlier part of the 20th century, have very big error bars on them, which are not normally taken into account. And it's entirely possible that there was very little, if any, warming over the last 100 years within the error bars of data. But the accepted interpretation of the data as we have them and without looking at their proper error bars is there is a degree warming about in the last 100 years about. Okay, so that's fine. The claim that temperature will increase by 2.5 to 4.5, was it, degrees by the end of the century is science fiction. There is no evidence for it. The claim is based upon the computer models that the IPCC use, which scores of scientific papers show are completely inadequate and are fine for playing scientific games, and I don't say that to put them down, because games playing is very important in science, but they're not predictive tools in any way, and they should most certainly not be being used to inform public policy, as regrettably they are, because the core of the IPCC's argument relates to these computer models, which, as predictive tools, are valueless.
And of course, if it were true, that's a very, very rapid rise in temperature, 3 to 4 times greater than what we've seen in the past 100 years. You'd be expecting to notice that, but instead, not only are we not noticing it, there has been no significant increase, and perhaps, as you say, a gentle decline over the last 17 years. So
Correct. We're
not seeing the evidence of that projection at all at the moment, are we?
That doesn't mean it couldn't occur, because fossil record shows us quite clearly that warmings as much as 1, 2, and 3 degrees can take place over just a few decades.
Mm.
But they're not caused by carbon dioxide. They're caused by other aspects of environmental variability. So I'm not for a minute do I say that it's not possible that temperature couldn't go up by 2 to 3 degrees by the end of the century. It could. What I'm saying is that the prediction that it will go up that amount based on carbon dioxide emissions is scientific nonsense.
Pure speculation. Lastly, let's just have a look at the claim that the missing heat has gone into the ocean. Now, this is one of the things that Leslie Hughes said in response to the ABC, who did actually raise the so-called pause in warming. And Leslie Hughes said that it appears that the heat has gone into the ocean.
we would wish that it had, because the rate of circulation of the ocean, roughly the atmosphere, circulates in about a year. So that's the mixing time of the atmosphere. But the mixing time of the ocean is 1,000 years or more. So if we're putting a little bit of extra heat into the ocean now and it's going into the deep ocean, it will reappear again in 1,000 years' time. Do you really think that's a problem that we should be spending present taxpayers' money on?
Right. Very interesting point.
And the second point about that is there is no evidence that there's extra heat going into the oceans. These measurements, such as we have them, and we only have them for about the last 10 years, indicate no warming of the upper ocean. It's about static, rather like the atmospheric temperature, which isn't surprising. They should be similar. And the claims by various very complex computer analyses and models that there is extra warming being detected in the deep ocean miss two things. One, that many scientists will argue with the details of the way those papers have been presented. And two, you can't get heat into the deep ocean without it first coming through the shallow ocean. And nobody has identified a mechanism by which that has or indeed can occur, because the shallow ocean is a warm puddle that sits on a very cold and deep ocean, and it's extremely hard to transmit heat across that, translate heat across that. So there's all sorts of problems with the claim that the heat is going into the oceans, and from where I sit, it looks like just another excuse as to why their models are wrong. I mean, the models predict there should be this extra heat. Perhaps there isn't this extra heat. Perhaps, for example, it's being bounced back to space by an increasing cloudiness. Very interesting recent paper by John McLean of Melbourne shows that a significant amount of the late 20th century warming is related to that issue, that if you have more low cloud, you bounce the heat back out to space.
Yeah.
Well, that's the same heat, or could be the same heat, that the IPCC says is missing.
Mm.
Not missing, it never got here, or it got as far as the clouds and then it gets bounced back again. So this whole business about ocean heat is a half-baked, at very best, a half-baked scientific theory.
Well, it comes across as a dog ate my homework sort of, excuse,
yes, indeed,
doesn't it?
Exactly.
One
has to admire the ingenuity, the sheer scientific ingenuity that goes into devising these various excuses, because they don't want to confront the implacable fact that I gave you earlier, which is for the last 17 years, no warming whatsoever. Last 17 years, carbon dioxide's gone up 10%, which is 33% of all the carbon dioxide we've ever put in the atmosphere. And you're seriously telling me you want to spend taxpayer time on stopping putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Absolutely. And I'm afraid on that note we'll have to end it. It's been really excellent talking to you today. I think we've made a small difference somehow, and I will not stop, and I do hope you continue as well, and we'll have you on again sometime in the future.
Thanks a lot, everyone.
Terrific. That's Truth News Radio Australia signing off for another week. I'll be back next week, folks. Looking forward to it. See you then.